Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Horrible Podcast. I'm Brian.
I'm Tyler.
And I'm Drew.
And before we get started, let me take a second here to invite all our listeners to come to the Frightening Ass Film Festival. That's in Chattanooga, October 31st, Halloween night. One of the few places you're going to be able to see The Babadook before it's out in wide release, if it actually makes it out wide release.
And it's not coming out until after October either. So
November, right. So we're getting that little special treat. Also, The Demon's Rook, which we've talked about on this show. Mm-hmm. A couple of Atlanta, Georgia boys did that. And then Texas Chainsaw Massacre 40th anniversary cut. I guess cut. It's cut, nothing wrong with them. The movie hasn't changed.
Edition. Yeah, no, it's the re
40th anniversary reissue or
And a couple of bands, White Reaper and So Crow. A couple little music guys and some comedians.
Yeah, it's going to be fun. Last year was really fun. Faff 4.
Hey, the faffening. That's what we wanted to call it, but nobody's referred to it as that yet.
But. Hashtag faffening.
Thanks to Notice Maximus for our theme song.
Dream Again.
And if you want to follow us on social media, we are Horrible PCast on Twitter. HorrorBullPCast. The HorriblePodcast.com is our website. Facebook, Google, everywhere else, The Horrible Podcast. iTunes, Horrible Podcast. Stitcher, The Horrible Podcast. Legion Podcast, The Horrible Podcast.
If you want to know, we can explain. We like to party at spring break. That's why our Twitter name is Horrible PCast. It's PC. We're PC assed. Am I right?
PC Horrible stands for Panama City.
Yeah, we are Panama City in it up.
For any listeners outside the southern United States.
PC. We should have called it the PC B-Cast.
You know, you probably didn't know this, but back when what's that show called that came on with the Orange County?
Yep.
I had written a little, a couple of episodes of a show called the PCB.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, sorry, it was OC. The OC, yeah. That was the name of their show.
You wrote the OC?
No, but I wrote the PCB, which kind of, it was about Panama City Beach.
And just a lot more venereal disease.
Yeah, people that lived there. There was like, the character had the older friend that had the uncomfortably young girlfriend. The 32-year-old who hung out with the 18-year-old. You're like, I know it's legal, but it still feels wrong.
yeah.
You got to find that on BrianCenter.com.
Oh, really?
I'll be selling those. Yeah.
Spec script section of BrianCenter.com.
Right, you can find it there.
So tonight's movie, Brian, what are we watching?
We continuing our classic horror. Classics. Classics to us. Nightmare on Elm Street.
The original.
The remake.
1984's Wes Craven's. Drew, would you call it his breakout? Like, would you that call it like? Would you consider like Last House on the Left big enough to be considered his big?
No, I mean this is I don't know. It just depends on the way you look at it. I mean, this is definitely the thing that put him in a different stratosphere than anything else. I mean, it put him in conversations that he would not have been in prior to that. He was he was a cult guy prior to that. Now he's the creator of one of the the biggest independent hits of And one of the biggest hits of that year, I guess, kind of deal,
Or, one of the most iconic movies of all time.
Yeah. One of the biggest, one of the biggest horror icons that, gets created. Arguably even, especially if you go back beyond the, your typical, your classic kind of monsters, it's arguable who's more iconic, Freddy or Jason. I mean, it just comes down to, it just comes down to preference almost.
Yeah. I think so too.
And I know that Drew did, and I think, Tyler, you mentioned you watched Never Sleep Again.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I did skim through a couple parts, but I watched the bulk of it this weekend too, and it was, if you are a fan of Nightmare on Elm Street, you need to watch that documentary. It is so in-depth, and so many cool stuff, like, the stuff I never even knew about Freddy versus Jason, all the screenplays it had gone through, how long it had taken to make it, and it's just, great, great story. And even the stories about Bob Shea and getting the first Nightmare on Elm Street made. And, I always get a kick, too, out of Robert Englund. Like, as much as I love everything he's in, is just, he's so, he wants goofy. To be such a thespian when it comes to Nightmare on Elm Street, and he tries. It's like that thespian. Wasn't what you were thinking, Robert Englund.
Thespian.
You told
with a P, not Mark a B. What I think makes that documentary so great is that they don't hold back. It's not for the sake of just uplifting the franchise. Like it gets into the dirt behind the making of these movies, and it's not just people kissing one another's asses. It wasn't just, oh, it was great to work with so-and-so. Oh, it was such an honor to work with so-and-so. There were definite moments in that documentary where you could feel a sense of tension about the production of those films. And I think I really respect that documentary for going into those aspects of production, because usually they're glossed over as like, whatever, people didn't get along, I'll say, who cares? It doesn't quite go into like the E! True Hollywood Story aspects of it, but it definitely makes clear that Bob Shea had an iron fist about that franchise, and not everyone was along for the ride with it. I mean, even up to Wes Craven, you know.
I mean, but I think the interesting thing is you always hear producers chat upon most of the time, but I think his instincts were pretty on the money for Nightmare for the most part. I mean, looking at how successful it was, I mean, critically and you
financially,
know,
monetarily. Financially.
I mean, it wasn't. I mean, you don't have many beyond the first one as acclaimed. But but as a franchise, it stands up. Its subsequent films stand up much better than any of the others. As a whole, it's the best, most complete franchise out of those big three. I mean, it easily, I think, best Halloween and Friday the 13th as far as series go.
And even though, I mean, Freddy did have a couple of quips in the first one, but he wasn't as kind of punny and I guess the like almost cheesy, even though his face looked like melted cheese. Am I right, guys?
Yeah.
Podcast from 1985. The he was he's fucking
vicious. He's still vicious in this. Yeah.
Yeah, and he is just to like rewatching it and thinking like, could you? These kids are supposed to be 16 years old.
Yeah.
And at one point, is it Tina says? She says, "God, I look like I'm 20." When she's looking at her face in the mirror, I was like, holy shit, I never really thought about how young these people were supposed to be in this film.
And they actually were 25. I'm just kidding.
That's probably why.
I still think Heather Langenkamp does seem younger than most any of her other peers in those other movies. Like in the Friday the 13th, like none of those people seem like they were teenagers. Those are college kids at camp doing stuff. Like, you know, and in Halloween, it never really felt like those were high schoolers, like Annie or or Laurie.
Like PJ Souls and all of them,
yeah.
Like they never really felt like high school. I mean, yeah, even though they were kind of that age, I think, yeah, Heather Langenkamp, I mean, she was, what, 18 when they made this, so she's still... She just had a look like a high school kid.
Yeah,
you know?
She did.
I think the franchise would have been vastly different if you had someone like Demi Moore, who totally didn't look like... She never quite looked like a high school student ever since she's become an actress. I think the movie would be vastly different if she were in it as Heather Langenkamp's character.
She doesn't blame it on Rio.
Right.
That's
the youngest she ever seemed.
She had to be 18 in that movie since she's making it.
Yeah.
And I mean, the movie's iconic. And what's great about the fact that we did it this time around, or just at all, is that in watching Nightmare on Elm Street critically, as opposed to just for laughs, I really thought the movie was a lot, like structurally, I think the movie's a lot better than I remember it being. Like looking at it critically, I was more entertained by it than I have the last several times I watched it. Like looking at it critically has made me... especially the first two acts. I think the third act gets kind of weird and silly.
Right.
But the first two acts, I think, are pretty solid. As far as, like, this is a scary... Like, the horror sequences are ones that are the most iconic to me. If you think about, like, the scenes where you have Tina on the ceiling, and then you have the head going through the rubber thing above her Heather Langenkamp's bed, and then you have the body in the body bag, and all of the things are so iconic.
When watching the remake, that still made me so mad that they went and did a shitty CG version of that that didn't look anywhere as cool as the practical,
the stretching.
Yeah,
and that can be an expensive effect. Like
the God, I think I may have been, let's see, 84. So I was
30. You were 30?
I was 30. I think I was 10 or 11 when this movie, when I first saw this movie. And I remember my sister telling my parents that she wasn't going to be scared if because I was a latchkey kid, so of course I watched my kid sister. So she was 7 or 8 downstairs watching that with us while we watched this. She's like, I won't be scared. She didn't sleep for in her room for 3 weeks straight.
Really?
Freddy Krueger's going to come after her. Oh my God, I got into so much trouble for this.
I don't remember the first time I watched the first one because I think I watched like most franchises, I watched them out of order, but this one always stuck out. Like I always attributed growing up parts of this movie to other Nightmare movies. Like I just thought all those moments can't be in one film, but incidentally they are, and it's amazing.
Yeah. Well, I mean the rest of the series, I mean, it's interesting to watch the Never Sleep Again and see how, while I remember stuff from later entries in the series, there aren't a lot of iconic moments.
Like 4 and 5 just kind of blend into one movie for me.
I can never remember which is which, first. Like I was a Dream Judge, Master, God damn it, whichever. 4.
I think 4. I have it now. Like after watching that, it's Dream Master and then Dream Child. Right.
The Master comes before the Child.
Right.
And then you get to
Freddy's Dead,
which is just unfortunate. Like that is an unfortunate end to that series.
I was so torn on that. Like everyone was so excited that Rachel Talalay got to direct one, but I attribute a lot of the problems with that one to her directing it as well. So I don't know. I think they would have been so fantastically better off if they had gone with that Peter Jackson story. Yeah, it sounded good.
The famed sixth Nightmare on Elm Street script, which has Peter Jackson writing it, it's kind of like, I'm trying to think of what I can compare it to, but Freddy is, people are intentionally, it's almost like a science fiction, like Terry Gilliam should have directed the Peter Jackson script because it's about kids who get high or they like huff stuff to go to sleep on purpose so they can go and taunt Freddy because he's so weakened. And then Freddy sort of accidentally kills one of these asshole kids who's going to taunt him and starts to get his power back. That seems like such a great script. Yeah. Like Terry Gilliam would make a fantastic movie like that.
Or just Peter Jackson would have.
Or just Peter Jackson, just a really super gory, intense movie. Yeah. If Bob Shea had only had the vision on that.
Yeah. I also wish they'd let Skip and Spectre, if they'd gone with their script for 5.
Which one was that? I think I've already forgotten that from even...
I've completely forgotten most of this.
I mean, it doesn't even matter what it was, just the idea that, you know, it was just the idea that you had that they were going with the splatterpunk.
Oh yeah, that's
horror
right.
Set at that point, and I just think it would have made it would have given it so much more of a mystique now to look back and be like, oh, that's the one that, you know, that's the one that John Skip wrote and things like that. For those who, you know, look into and know the splatterpunk stuff,
and it's almost,
that would have been interesting.
It's so funny too that they were able to almost pinpoint the moment where Freddy starts to become, you know, this a caricature of himself, and it's in the third movie where, incidentally, like, Robert Englund says a line that's better than the script and people laugh and it's hilarious and frightening at the same time. And welcome to prime time, bitch, becomes then the thing that vaults Freddy. Vaults Freddy to something more than just a horror character. Like he then becomes, you know, and what separates Freddy from all the rest is that he talks. He's not just some like silent stalking madman. And, you know, that's what separates him.
And it makes him ultimately much more interesting in some ways, but also what turns him into a problem later is you had to make him into kind of an anti-hero kind of deal, because eventually he is the person you're almost pulling for in some regards, because he has more personality than anyone else. No one else has a personality in them.
And let's not forget, these kids are dirty sinners.
Right. It is weird how they have to turn him into an anti-hero, and also they have to raise the stakes every time. There was no way after Welcome to Primetime, Bitch, that he could have stepped back into the shadows and become creepy again.
It's a new nightmare.
Well, yeah, but
you had to turn the whole concept on its head.
Yeah, like you had to change direction. Like that movie was an entire change in direction from where the movie was, the series was headed. And ultimately, I still like 3 the best, I think, of the whole franchise.
3's awesome. I mean, 3
is just a
fantastic.
Great movie. Yeah, it's just a great, and I think 4 could have been a lot better if they had managed to score Patricia Arquette and had her reprise the role. Like, that's something I always forget, is that she was in 3 and supposed to be in 4, but actually wasn't. And that's so weird. Also, the thing that's most upsetting about Never Sleep Again is whenever Tuesday Knight shows up, right? As the roller derby painted goth princess that she is. Like, I'm all for it. I think that's great to, but it's still like, where, like,
it was distracting in that
because she's having a totally normal conversation, but also has a sort of like person in frame with her who's almost like whatever. I don't know. It's just, it's strange. Yeah. Anyway,
it just didn't fit. Like you said there, it just took me out of, what is she talking about? I'm too busy trying to figure out what she's doing.
Yeah.
Plus also we did get Don Dokken in there, and that's always
fun. When I saw that part, I was like, these guys, the horrible podcast guys would love this part so much. They would love it.
Dokken.
So 2/3 of us have actually seen that performed live.
Yeah.
And I like how he
says,
Brian,
you should see him.
Did you see that section, Brian, where he talks about, he's like, I couldn't even hit those notes then. That song was so high. He was like, oh my gosh, it was great. He was like, yeah, I couldn't hit those notes pretty much right after the song was done. I couldn't hit it. It's ridiculously high. And then he talks about how his other version and how the band shot it down and he sang it right then. And they're like, yeah, that would have been terrible. It's bad.
They did. So moving sort of into the movie itself, like, I think it is pretty strong starting out. And I was actually surprised how much I like the beginning still. As far as like introducing them, the dialogue in the beginning sort of forced and corny. And I think that's ultimately other than the third act, the dialogue is the corniest aspect of the movie. And like, that's, it's unfortunate how bad the dialogue still is. Like, up your hose with a rolling lawnmower. Yeah. Just that sort of, it's very stagey. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, though, the 80s were great at making the groups of friends so odd. Like, remember, in Return of the Living Dead, none of those people wouldn't have all hung out together.
Never in a million years. Like, wow, yeah.
And Tina and the jock guy with the punks and the new wave Elvis Costello crew with their skinny ties. But the there's no way that Rod and Johnny Depp were supposed to be football players.
Yeah.
Well, they addressed that in the documentary a little bit.
And Johnny Depp's just kind of, he changed the performance a little bit. And it's still weird, though, because Rod doesn't seem like to fit in with the entire group at all.
It's almost like when you watch Dazed and Confused and you think, oh, my God, that's what jocks used to be like? The ones that got high and...
In the 70s, like that,
I didn't have a problem with that, because what I just saw is Rod was the boyfriend of the kind of trashy friend that Nancy had, and that was the thing, and he didn't fit, because they wouldn't have hung out together other than they had that connection of Nancy and Tina.
And Tina she can't resist him.
The Tina's mom with her, that scene where she comes to the door, like opens the door after the first nightmare, and the guy like shows up to me. He's like, hey, when you come back to bed, baby.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ, give it a rest, bro.
Throughout the series, there is a weird father, like daddy issues thing going on.
Totally.
In the undercurrent. Well, it starts in that movie, And
not to mention that all the parents in these movies have killed someone.
Yeah.
They're all like responsible in some way for Freddy Krueger dying.
Yes. It's almost like I just finished a James Ellroy novel, so I'm like connecting everything to him, but almost it seems like something people would do in an Ellroy novel. Like the cops have, let off this murderer for political reasons or whatever, and then like the townsfolk take it into their own hands. So, I mean, it's hard to root for what happened to him, though, and I think the movie does a good job with like describing how they did something that they still feel kind of ashamed of, even though they did it for reasons they thought were sort of like chivalrous.
Yeah, I often wonder too. I know Freddy is evil, but I mean, you're kind of a dick. I mean, you did do some shitty stuff to be haunting their kids for basically just taking the law into their own hands. Come on, dude.
Well, he does. He's an illogical person. I'll say that.
I like how they make it clear in the first one that he is not. They don't want him. He's bad, but he's not that bad. They don't allow him to be a child molester.
Just a child murderer.
Child murderer. Like they specifically call him a child murderer.
But we know what that means.
It's so weird that they tried to tiptoe around the fact that he was a child molester. I guess it's because of all the things that were going on. But if you want to make someone a villain, like today they would not tiptoe around child molester.
They didn't, did they, in the remake?
No, I don't remember.
The Nancy character had, there's that like little room behind the boiler room that he went to, and
I sort of emotionally.
Plus, it was Jackie Earle Haley, and he has had to play a child molester, right?
It was during his child molester trilogy.
Child molester.
His Kitty Fiddler trilogy. I sort of emotionally turned off to the third one and intellectually turned off to the third one after the guy in the diner slit his own throat in front of everyone. I was like, this is way too not what I was looking for in this movie. So, I just don't like that movie. It's not very good.
Also, too, I thought, obviously Rod wasn't thinking when this happened, but if he had just stayed in the room and, like, I didn't. This is what happened. Like, they wouldn't have found any murder weapons. He didn't have knives in the room with him.
They were
going to run that guy. Yeah, he was done. Yeah. Like, what else are they going to do except that it was some sort of dream killer? Nah. They're going to blame the trashy boyfriend.
What's weird is that, like, it gets turned on his head because that's literally what was going on. They all knew. If Rod had only had a chance to explain honestly what was going on, even if they ran him, like they had a sort of a kangaroo court for him, still they would have known. Like that would have made the parents even more culpable, because if he started talking about this guy and dreams with knives for fingers and they still if the movie went differently, if this turned into a courtroom drama instead of a horror movie, then the parents would have been even more culpable because they would have let a teenager go to prison for the murder of someone that like they have blood on their hands for.
That was our prequel. Yeah. It was awesome. But yeah, Brian had a really pretty awesome prequel. Yeah. Just called Elm Street. And it was, you know,
we had as Freddy Krueger before he hit it big again.
Yeah, if you thought the nightmare was over, it hasn't even begun.
Oh, that's a nice tagline.
It was going to start. It was going to have the whole deal with, you know, with him and the, you know, the kids and what he was doing and his trial and how he gets off, and then it's going to end with the parents, you know, doing the murder of him and him dying, and I don't know, calling forth some evil djinn or something, whatever the hell he did that, you know, gives him whatever demonic power it does. But it was pretty badass.
If only, man.
It took the whole idea from the scene. There's a cut scene that I've only seen once that has Nancy's mom admitting to it. When she's in the basement, shows the glove. She also admits to her having an older sibling. It says all those kids on Elm Street had older kids, and they were all the kids that Freddie murdered. And that was their reason for doing that, is like he had killed their kids. It wasn't just that he was a child killer in the neighborhood.
Yeah.
He had killed their kids.
I think that's a good extension of the fiction.
Nobody, the copyright, Harbor Podcast 2014.
I like that you're including me in this. I accept. Thank you.
Well, you're our published author.
The other aspect of the movie that I think is really interesting is it doesn't have a truly traditional horror movie structure. And I guess there wasn't really a thing like a slasher movie template set by 84. Maybe there was, but this one kind
of
subverts it.
I would say there was a slasher. I mean, by Friday, the template was kind of set
true.
There. But
that's
this
true.
Is different. That was
but this
thing.
One is different because it doesn't. I guess I never really bought the idea that Tina was kind of the hero, or that they tried to sort of lean that way in the beginning to like, and then pull the, you know, rug out from under
psycho.
You.
Psycho. I don't know that I ever thought that either, but I mean,
but it's also because I've seen the movie 100 times.
True. I already know Nancy's the heroine.
Yeah. They show Tina's the first and most important image you see for a very long time. Right. And so, you know, she's in the beginning and it's her dreams and, you know, she is the first. It's one of the most iconic and brutal still. Even today, it's still an unsettling thing to watch, the way that she's murdered.
The way Go ahead.
No, you go.
The way she's murdered and then the effect it has on, I mean, Nancy goes to school the next day. Doesn't she make a comment about that? It's like, what
the
good
parents,
about it?
Yeah, well, the mom and dad are both like, you're not going to school. It's like, yeah, what else, you know, whatever, what else am I going to do? Yeah.
John Saxon.
Yeah.
Oh, man, he's awesome.
He's amazing.
I love John Saxon.
I like how he alludes to how many cops he's played. Like,
a lot. Okay. The answer is a lot.
But no, like that scene where she's at school the next day and she starts falling asleep in class, mm-hmm. and then has the way that guy says the, like, were it not that I was half bad dream, that yeah. always freaked me out. And even like the dragging of Tina's body mm-hmm. down the hallway. Yeah.
That was always so freaky to me. That was one of the scenes that I found most unsettling growing up. I mean, this movie's full of things that are just unsettling to watch. I mean, someone being dragged in a body bag through a hallway, like that's all, because what separates this movie from the rest of the Friday, excuse me, from the rest of the Nightmare on Elm Street movies is that a lot of the violence is implied and Freddy's not actually on screen. Like, that's what makes this movie so witty, like, in retrospect, is it's not him just showing up and hacking people up. And when he is on screen, it's less effective. Like, the things that are most corny in this movie are when, like, he shows up and then hacks off his own fingers and, like, look at all the worms in my stomach. That stuff just totally doesn't work.
I hate the arms. The yeah. long arms in that yeah. that opening sequence. I've just never been. Mm-hmm. I liked hearing in the movie how they did it, mm-hmm. but it's never been a scene that I've found particularly appealing in execution or look or anything.
A lot of the stuff where he's on screen is not effective. Like when you think about the little person who chases Tina down the alleyway, and then Freddy's at the end of the alleyway. Like you don't mm-hmm. expect it. That kind of stuff never really worked for me. Like, none of that has ever been that scary. I mean, I think later movies do some of that stuff a little bit better, but it's just it just came off as it's silly-ish, you know.
Freddy, the bathtub sequence is probably the yeah. most effective Freddy yeah. use of Freddy.
And that's not even Robert Englund. That's the sad part, is that's not even Robert Englund, but that's like the most effective use of Freddy in the opening scene. That yeah. I would say that and the shadow that gets cast in the boiler room when Nancy first shows up in the dreams. Like, those are the two best moments, I think. Maybe when Freddy jumps through the mirror. That was also pretty effective.
Good one. Yeah, that was
yeah.
good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are several. It's just not, there are just several that like don't
missteps.
Work as well.
Yeah, like
the best one was the tongue phone.
I think, didn't they say that Heather Langenkamp took that home, or were they just joking?
I don't know.
But yeah, like I'm sure the movie would have worked even better, I think, with fewer instances of Freddy, or fewer instances of him trying to show that, hey, this is a dream world and I'm a messed up killer.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even think one of the biggest problems that they said they had, that anyone thinks they had with Nightmare 2, is when Freddy comes out yeah. into the real world at the pool party. Yeah. And there, and I mean, even Wes Craven was like, that was the part that's like, no,
yeah,
like, that's just like,
that ruins the fiction of the world.
That's
entirely.
Not it at all. It's like,
but what's weird is that when I was 7 or whatever, the first time I saw Elm Street 2 and that scene happened, when he says, you're all my children now.
That's great. I like that.
That was one of my most intense, frightening moments watching a movie growing up. I was just so freaked out by that idea as a kid. Yeah. Like,
and he came out with his gloved hand and was like, diddle, 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 diddle.
But I really like that moment and that bit of dialogue there. It's just, you know, all the other stuff didn't work. Although I did like that he could somehow... He had like some magical ability to like boil the pool or something.
Right.
I never understood what he was using there.
You know, I think 2 is a pretty weak movie overall, but it has some really interesting parts. Like, I always like the trans. Yeah. That's something we might have to do just like another podcast about. But
I think so.
The transformation scene where he actually comes out. I always thought that was really gross and unsettling. As far as like the rest of the stuff in that movie doesn't really work for me. It's a really boring movie.
Yeah. 2 is my least watched Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah. I say 3 is my most watched.
But also it does have in its favor Clue Gulager, though. That is easily its number one thing yeah. that it does have. And he's so great in the documentary as well.
He's amazing in the documentary.
He's like some weirded out Barry Bostwick.
Yeah. Agreed. So as far as the opening, the first act of the movie, I think, is really strong because you have you set up the fear that all of these people feel. And the movie it's not always subtle. Like, subtlety is not this movie's strength, but the way that we all learn that the kids are experiencing the same thing through minor clues is really cool. Like Rod using the three-pronged gardening tool to do the shrieking sound. Like, he doesn't say, I mean, later he does say, you don't, you guys have nightmares too. But yeah. That scene where he just says, this is, like, he's just saying, this sounds freaky. He's not, we get that, like, the dramatic tension is that we get that he's having nightmares, but he doesn't say it. And I think that the movie would be better if, like, there wasn't any discussion, if he just, like, hid it from people or something.
Or, like, there's a couple times when the name Freddy is mentioned that, like, the parents don't.
You mean Fred. He's only called Fred, I think, in the original. Even in the credits, he's Fred Krueger.
But his name is mentioned without any reaction from some of the parents. Like, if your kids are having nightmares about a guy with a, you know, who's Nancy's mom happens to have the gloves still in their house.
Why would you keep that, really?
I think that should have been a way bigger revelation in the movie. When it happens, it should have been a much bigger moment, but she treats it like...
Oh, by the way,
here this is. And she's like, oh! And then it moves on. Like, the whole movie moves. Like, if
but
I had
she should
no-
be angry at her mom and, you know, it's like...
All these things, like, this is... She has been given this huge revelation that they all killed Fred Krueger. And then she has the thing that he uses to kill people in their basement. And it's just like, she just sort of, like... sighs, and then that's it. Like, that's really the end of that scene. And that scene should have been, like, way more scaled up than it was.
I'm really surprised and most likely grateful that was never made the key to killing him.
Right.
Like, burying the glove or getting rid of the glove or having done away with the glove somehow.
Because they do it later.
Yeah.
They kind of do it later, kind of. So as far as, like, the first two acts are really strong through as far as Tina's death goes. And then the stuff I thought with Rod was really interesting. Kind of ham-handedly done. Like, he shows up and kidnaps her for a second, and then they have him and take him to jail. But
he wasn't
still
getting away from them. He didn't even have shoes on. He wasn't running away from anybody.
He didn't have time to put them on and running away from everyone.
It's like, this guy is on the run. He's missing, but we think he's in the trees next to the house that we thought he was. You go ahead and walk to school, Nancy. We think he's going to reach out to you.
But then he used her as they used her as bait. Like, they're thinking that he'll just be in. What?
They think he's a murderer, and they still let John Saxon still lets his daughter be abducted by him.
I still think didn't both the mom and dad not think she was going to school? How did they even think that plan was going to work? They weren't planning for her to go to school.
The murder the criminal always comes back to the scene of the crime.
Also, they just don't trust their daughter, apparently.
What teenager really goes to school when both their parents are saying, well, I guess that's the thing. The parents were saying she didn't have to go, so of course she has to go then.
Yeah. No, I'm fine. It's fine. I'm going.
You literally witnessed a fish tank of blood on your friend's bed, so you can probably stay home today. God, I'd have milked that for like at least a week.
at least a week.
I would have gone to school.
I'm sure.
Because you'd have been cool at that point. Everybody would want to talk to you. Yeah. Come on.
To cynically use your friend's death as a means for climbing the social ladder.
Tomorrow in Talking with Psychopaths. Sociopaths.
That's more sociopath.
Yeah, that's more sociopath.
I corrected myself.
What's your favorite death in the movies, guys? Like, this is something...
All of them or just that one?
No, what is your favorite one? Like, what's your favorite death scene?
I liked puppet scene.
Are you saying in this movie
in this one. In one specifically.
I like Johnny Depp's.
Johnny Depp's is probably mine too. And I like that idea, and again, I saw Never Sleep Again, where the body is supposed to shoot out of the bed after they show the scene of it. It's weird looking.
I'm glad they cut that.
It's so weird looking, but in a good weird way, I thought. I was like, oh.
I just like the idea of the blood fountain. That was such a cool idea.
Yeah. Yeah, how would his body come out as unmarred as that?
Right.
For one, but the blood gushing out is fantastic. That's a pretty awesome death.
What that documentary also seems to show to me is how close to completely missing the mark any movie is. Like, there are some very specific choices that mean the difference between a classic and a completely miss mark as far as movies goes, because that movie was a couple of bad scenes away from being like a corny version of itself.
Yeah. Every time I watch like a great movie, like a making of, every like good movie or movie that I like is always a step away from just being a complete completely collapsing and not getting made. Like even talking to the Demon's Rook guys, they're like, you know, at the last minute everyone couldn't show up and we had to just go with what we had. And, you know, it's really cool how like it's how I imagine like how the world works most days. We're almost not making it most days.
It's, I mean, anything that's made collaboratively, it's amazing that anything is ever any good when you think about it. Because if you have that many people working on a thing, it doesn't matter because it's not one person's vision. It's everyone's vision. So the fact that all these things can go wrong on, say, A Nightmare on Elm Street and it still work. Or, I mean, if Jaws, it's fortuitous that the shark didn't even really work because that's what made the movie great.
Yeah.
Right.
So, sometimes it's just a stroke of luck rather than a stroke of genius.
Kismet. I would love to have seen the David Warner Freddy Krueger. I'm fascinated by that idea after seeing that. Like, I mean, obviously, Robert Englund's Freddy Krueger is, you know, and I'm not saying I would prefer another one. I'm not saying, man, I wish someone else had started out. I love David Warner and the idea of what his Freddy might have been. Some sort of British, you know, stage acting version of Freddy or something.
This movie's so
jimmy, bitch.
This movie's so stagey for me anyway. The dialogue especially, I mean, it seems like it would almost fit in a way because the movie's, I mean, the dialogue is so sort of exposition-y. Like, how am I, here are the things that I know, and here, this thing that we are talking about will now inform the thing that's going to happen in the very next scene in this movie.
Like, when that time machine, the H.G. Wells?
Oh, I don't know what he left for. I think he just realized what he signed on for. Yeah. And he's like, I've got something else to do.
It's so funny, too, because this movie became such a sort of boon to everyone who was in it. And we saw the same thing with, we've seen the same thing with other movies. Like we talked about with Friday the 13th last week. I mean, Betsy Palmer played Jason's mom and thought the script was shit. Someone else was originally scripted to play Jason's mother. And I can't remember who it is at present.
Let me help you out there, Tyler. It was actually the lead singer of Dr. Hook.
Yeah, it was the lead singer of Dr. Hook.
Mad when that part was taken away, he wrote Sylvia's Mother.
Thanks. I love that song, actually. That's one of my favorite songs.
I know you do.
It's a great breakup song. So we get to the scenes after Ron has died, and I think like the parents start to get that something weird is going on here. So they have the sleep study, and the sleep study seems like such a weird anachronism for a horror movie that it almost turns into The Exorcist at that point. Like it almost becomes about the parent midway through, or I guess with 40 minutes left.
Isn't the doctor the voice of Roger Rabbit?
Yes, he was. Yes, Charles Fleischer.
Yeah, that was Charles Fleischer. It's so weird. And the reason that I always thought, in looking back, Lynn Shay being in the movie makes sense now, but when I watched it up to Nightmare on Elm Street, I didn't make the connection because I never knew Lynn Shay's actual name. I was just like, oh, it's Magda from There's Something About Mary.
Yeah, I knew her name, but I did not realize that was, I didn't make her that connection. I was like, oh, holy shit, Bob Shay's sister, of course.
So that's why she's in the movie as the teacher. It's so weird. But yeah, it almost becomes about the parents when she has the sleep study. And we lose the perspective. Like, she almost becomes like Reagan from The Exorcist at that point because we lose her perspective. We don't go into the dream with her at all. All we get is a scene where she's acting and Freddy is there. Like, the threat of that scene is completely taken away because we don't go into the dream. We just see her thrash around. And then miraculously, what should have been the most miraculous moment of the movie,
she brings his hat back.
It's done completely third person. We are watching this happen from outside. Like, we don't go into the dreams for the first time, and something amazing and miraculous happens. That's for me when the movie starts to turn. Like, oh, they don't quite know what they have here.
She's close enough to him to get the hat.
Yeah, and he's been such a dangerous psychopath. The fact that we don't get to see her fight back in this moment to be able to get his hat out of the dream, that's such a weird and bizarre thing to do in this movie.
I think it's just because he was asleep. She snuck in and he was just, you know, it was one of those times that he was just sleeping. It's like one of those things where you see the guy trying to steal something from a giant, you know, while they're asleep and they snatch it and then get away. I like to think that's what happened. Because I'd like to also see later him without a hat. Because what does he have? An endless supply of hats?
That would
these
be a funny
come by in the afterlife.
That would be almost a funny cartoon, like a three-panel cartoon as Freddy's hats. Or Freddy sleeping, like someone sneaking in on Freddy sleeping. Like, when does he sleep? Does he just sleep in other people's dreams?
What does he dream about?
Yeah, isn't that in the movie? Isn't that one in Final and New Nightmare? Don't they get into Freddy's dream?
They get into.
They go in that world.
I'm sorry. It's the Freddy versus Jason. They were talking about that, like how Freddy get into Jason's world and vice versa, that kind of stuff.
I have not seen that movie since opening night.
Freddy goes through Jason's dreams, I believe. Estelle Parsons apparently was originally signed for Mrs. Voorhees.
She was, because she was in Clue. Like, she's a famous, super famous actress. That would have been a really weird thing, like movie with her in it, right? Wasn't she in Clue? Didn't she play the sort of? Didn't she play Miss Peacock in Clue? Anyway.
Yes. It's been a long time since I've watched Clue.
I watched it 2 days ago. That's why.
Okay. Well, there you go.
It was on Netflix, and Kate wanted to. She was like, oh, let's watch Clue. And yeah. I always thought John Landis directed that movie, but he just wrote it. Oh, okay. He didn't actually direct it. Weird. So, what do you guys think of the last half of the movie? It starts to fall apart and become sort of a wacky horror Home Alone for me.
You were thinking of Eileen Brennan.
Gotcha. Well, damn it. Oh, well.
Not a big deal. I don't know. It's like a lot of these movies. It just gets, I don't know if it's just because I've watched them so much at this point, but I find the last act of a lot of these movies to end up being just kind of boring now once it gets to the inevitable showdown. Chase is a lot less interesting than everything leading up to it kind of deal. I like her booby trapping the house, like the silliness of that, because
it is
still the problem, because the whole thing is so the plan is to bring him into the real world and then use your booby traps to take him out, because I could probably, if I'm bringing him in the real world, just get a shotgun and just blow him away. It'd be a lot easier.
Your dad is a cop. I would be much more interested in the end of that movie if Nancy broke into the police station a la like an assault on Precinct 13 and like stole a whole collection of weapons and brought them back and was just like mowing Freddy down with shotguns and machine guns. That would be awesome.
Yeah, if I'm bringing him back to the real world, I'm not going to try and kill him with an exploding light bulb.
Right. Or a sledgehammer or a bucket full of thread.
I'm not going to kill him like Wile E. Coyote or something.
They didn't have it planned out very well. She had the
Christmas ornaments under the window.
What is he? He's the fucking Roadrunner. And saying, it's like
the Wet Bandits.
A nail on the steps. Tar. Yeah, like it just feels like Home Alone. I don't know. As a kid, I thought that was cool. As an adult, I think it's dumb. But right. I understand. Like, I think it's kind of neat, but it's entirely informed by the Johnny Depp scene where they're on the bridge and he's just like, "Hey, have you ever heard of people doing this in their dreams? Like, they can control them and stuff." And then that's how she gets to the conclusion that, "Hey, I'm gonna booby trap my house and hopefully that's gonna kill him."
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Maybe the idea of her,
I like the idea of her taking this into her own hands instead of relying on someone else. Like she,
right?
She is not relying on Johnny Depp or her dad or anything like that. She is the sort of like aggressor in all of this, and I think that's really cool.
Let's talk about feminism in horror films.
We have been. It's weird in movies like this because in Never Sleep Again, they talked about the weird sexual angle. The reason that they get female protagonists is not because they're stronger, but because they are ostensibly weaker and more, like, there is more of a sexual element to the violation when the killer invades their space. And I find that far less interesting than the idea that a woman is just a really good protagonist.
Well, I mean, I think it comes down to that. I mean, I still think the biggest problem with talking about Hostel and Hostel 2, I think we talked about this when we talked about Hostel 3, is in the first one, I don't give a shit about those asshole dudes. Right. Somebody kill them.
Yeah.
But then the three girls is like, oh no.
Yeah.
What's happening? It's like some weird, some weird inbred chivalry or something like kicks in, or it's like, oh, I don't want that to happen to them.
Right.
Those dudes were assholes.
Yeah. Well, also, I find my, I find myself rooting for female characters, I guess for the same reasons you just said. They also weren't quite the complete jerks that the guys in the first movie were. Like, I don't find it that hard to root for protagonists in horror movies. It doesn't take a lot, obviously, but yeah, I've always kind of liked a female protagonist in a movie. Like, I kind of, because it changes the dynamic of the movie, and it becomes less about like, well, I'm just good. Like, usually when it's a guy, it's like, well, I'm going to fight now that I've figured out what I'm going to do. Like, there's right. usually less of an element of wit when it comes to fighting the big bad.
I do like going back to you talked about how you thought that the ending worked when you're like a kid or something like that. But I guess that kind of makes sense. And that's also how Nancy would possibly plan to do it. It's a much more teenage sort of plan, I think, than it is an adult plan. An adult would not have sat there and said, I'm going to booby trap my house.
And, once,
unless we're talking about Freddy versus Jigsaw or something.
Well,
we talk about like having it influence you when you were a kid, thinking that would be the way to do it. After seeing Predator, the first time I saw Predator, I wound up booby trapping my backyard. And the kid who lived behind us, we had a privacy fence built. And the only way he could get to my backyard was he had to cut, like, shimmy through these little privacy fence area. Oh, my God. I had, like, a spring-loaded piece of wood with nails on it to come and smack him in the leg when he would...
God.
You know what's weird is
We bent the tree down to try to get the little, you know, leg traps for when he stepped into the very obvious rope hanging down from the tree.
That's actually a fine point. I mean, Predator, I think, is interesting almost precisely because it doesn't... It's interesting for a lot of reasons, but the ending is interesting because it's not just brute strength against brute strength. Yeah. And it is about those weird booby traps. I think the 80s had a lot of movies like that.
80s like the gate, booby traps.
Maybe, like, the gate. How did they
booby
end
traps?
Up...
Booby traps.
Booby traps? Did they end up using booby traps in the gate as well? Do you
that
remember?
That was Rocket. They used the rocket that they alluded to in the very first couple of scenes that he got taken away from him to, I guess it was Filled With Love.
Filled With Love is my favorite Kiss song, unreleased Kiss song ever.
It's a B-side.
Yeah, it's a B-side. So,
Filled With Love.
So, I mean, the end of the movie, it is definitely sort of haphazardly thrown together the way that a teenager would do it. So, I mean, to that extent, it like really works. It's not as satisfying.
I believed explorers could happen when I first. I was like, this could happen.
Oh, man.
I can build a spaceship and travel.
Right.
Forgot about explorers.
Mac and Me is real.
Mac and Me is shit.
Mac and Me was awful.
Mac and Me is just an E.T. ripoff.
Yes.
Explorers is awesome. Mac explorers. And Me, not so much.
Explorers is good.
Explorers is Joe Dante, right?
I believe so.
Yes. I think so.
The touching briefly on the Freddy versus Jason stuff, because that's what I found most interesting about that, the Never Sleep Again documentary, the idea of all the things that they had, the other stuff they had planned or talked about before, like after it was such a huge success. Like, it was like the, didn't he say that it was Freddy vs. Jason still like one of the number, the highest ranking horror films?
I don't know about that. Like, that's dubious distinction.
It was a huge success.
It's the longest, it took the longest from the idea to conception. Like, it took a really long production schedule for all of the legalese they had to jump through.
It might have held some opening weekend box office thing, maybe.
But the idea that they had Freddy versus Jason versus Ash.
I've heard about that for a long time. Yeah.
I was so, like, when they alluded to the whole...
Pinhead?
Yeah.
Fuck,
I was like,
yeah. Oh,
it would have been so fucking amazing.
Yeah, that it's just not going to happen.
Just to be a problem, boys.
Yeah, that would have been... And that's the thing. Just give them the rights just for that scene.
All we
I don't
need
even need the whole movie. I just want that scene to happen, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want Clive Barker to write that movie. I want to see how someone obsessed with sort of like BDSM and torture would deal with that film. Because I think he's the most, like, of all the people who have authored these products, I think Clive Barker is by far the most fucked up of all of them, as far as like his imagination.
Well, Hellraiser definitely was a different horror film than anything else.
I can't
I
wait to
watched.
Do it next year when we do this again.
But just, I remember it made me, like, the scenes in Hellraiser with the wife and the uncle, they always made me feel so dirty. I felt so dirty after Uncle Frank.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anything that Clive Barker is in contact with has that feeling. It's just dread and just icky. There's something icky about everything he's written, because there's just, because I haven't read a lot of his fiction. I think that's something I'm going to try to start working on, is reading some Clive Barker.
I read most all of it, up to the newest stuff. I think Sacrament might be the first thing I didn't read.
Because I read most of Cold Heart Canyon.
Yeah, that's new. I didn't read any of that.
It was super messed up. It was way too long, so I stopped reading it.
I've been reading The Next Testament, his comic book. It's pretty good.
So, highly recommend Weave World, Imagica, Great and Secret Show. Then you have Everville's not bad. I like all of those. I mean, all the short stories are good. Yeah. Imagica was probably my favorite. I really loved it. There's Weave World I really liked a lot, too.
There's a place in Nashville called McKay's Books. Brian, I think there's one in Chattanooga, too. I think you always say that, right?
There's one in Chattanooga as well.
Okay, that's right. And they have a lot of, they have a whole section of horror fiction of authors I've never really even heard of.
Oh, wow.
So I'm gonna be digging into that. It's like, and they're all like a quarter, so it's really awesome.
About just putting your book up there and just hoping that someone finds, like just planting it, not as like you're in there to make money, just to see if someone will buy it and take it home and be like, have you read this guy?
If I could get I haven't thought about that, but that would be a good guerrilla technique for.
It is interesting.
You're welcome.
Yeah, everything has a barcode there, so they just be like, I don't know, I guess I'll toss it. It's free.
I guess
that's still worth it. I mean,
it would still be worth it if they picked it up and read it. Yeah.
Yeah. You should go put it in Walden Books. Oh.
Oh. I could put it in Chapter 13. Oh.
Barnes and Noble.
I'm reading my first Richard Layman finally for my October book.
What is what are you reading?
The Cellar, his second book, I think.
I never read that one.
It's the first Beast House book.
Yeah, I read the Beast House, which was later. Yeah.
Were they? Are these the books that were on sale from the e-horror bargains place? I saw a bunch of.
Well, yes, they were, but it was also just available through Amazon Prime, so I just borrowed it.
Gotcha.
All right, so let's finish up with the ending of the movie. This is one of the most controversial aspects of A Nightmare on Elm Street. Is all of the ending stuff. Yeah, all of the ending stuff. So.
Never liked it.
Nancy Vanquish. I do love the scene of Freddy jumping on the mom who was a skeleton and them going into the. That was super cool.
I'm fine with that. I mean the real ending. I love
the coda.
Nancy's defeating Freddy with by taking away his power. I think that's fantastic.
I think structurally, like as a metaphor, also that works. And they're in the documentary. They talk a lot about how they needed something else so that they could sequelize it and have have a sequel to it. I don't think you needed that to be able to say, like, we're just going to have another one of these movies. I think that's a huge misstep. And was that Bob Shea's idea? I don't think Wes Craven came up with that. I think that was a Bob Shea idea.
Which part?
The ending with the car and the doll.
Yeah, Shea wanted something that would... I think Craven just wanted it in nicely, and Shea wanted the thing that would allow them to do the sequel. I mean, I think Wes, if I understood correctly, wanted them getting in the car and driving away, and you see the little girls. And I think that would have been, evocative enough. Yeah. Like, you know, oh shit, there's still something there. I like the roof of the car is fantastic. Yeah. I hate the mom being pulled through the door.
Yeah.
Hate it with a passion.
It's the worst.
My favorite part of the movie.
It is the worst.
Hate it. Always have. I never liked it. I don't even remember watching it the first time being like, oh, yeah. I was like, nah, I hate that.
Also, Johnny Depp's car, maybe the raddest car a 16-year-old high schooler could have.
Right.
Jesus. It's like a beautiful, beautifully restored 57 Chevy cherry red convertible.
It's still just shot like a dream, though. Like, it's so overexposed and things like that. It looks so dreamy.
Yeah. And the ending is regrettable. And it's weird because it doesn't, like, the ending that was shot and, presumably the end by Wes Craven doesn't preclude a sequel. Like, they didn't learn that until later. Right. Yeah. You can just make a sequel. Also, they didn't know that they had a hot property on their hands. It's weird, you know?
But they knew things could be sequelized. That was the thing. It doesn't matter nowadays whether you just make it where it's ready for a sequel, whether you think it's going to have a sequel or not, kind of deal.
Yeah, it's weird, too, because they sort of discuss it like, well, they were banking on this to make money back for the studio because it's dying. And they don't... like they say, like, oh, Bob Shea was ready to do a sequel the next day, but it was pretty obvious that he was planning on doing a sequel to this before it was even done, because the way they frame it in the documentary is, oh, once he saw that the movie did well, then he really jumped on the sequel. But it seemed like he was like ready for the sequel even before it came out.
Yes, I just misunderstood that, because I thought the point they were making is that he was looking for a sequel from the beginning. That's why he wanted that ending. Maybe I just missed it.
BoJack Horseman.
What?
No, I know something. I haven't watched it.
Your comment about the studio was, you know, in bank going under, it reminded me. There's a scene in there with Penguin Publishing going under. They're just all waiting, like they're burning their books to stay warm until this BoJack's book comes out. I'm just making me think about that. Bob Shea selling the stuff out of the back of his car.
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's a weird Cinderella story for Bob Shea, who, if A Nightmare on Elm Street tanks, like it almost seems like horror would be a little bit different. Like, it would definitely be different. And it's interesting to see how it would be. And New Line became a huge studio. Yeah. Everything would be different with horror.
If you don't get Lord of the Rings.
Or Scream.
Yeah. But, I mean, we don't get a lot of other stuff. If Nightmare doesn't hit, there's a lot. I mean, we could just kind of go down the line. And
Wes Craven. What happens to Wes Craven if this movie doesn't hit? Does he start making non-horror movies earlier?
No, I mean, I think he still makes horror. I mean, I think if it doesn't hit, it doesn't hit. He just ends up having to make smaller. He just ends up making smaller stuff. I think that's what you end up with. I mean,
directly into Serpent and the Rainbow.
Yeah, I mean, it ends up being like any of these guys. All of these guys end up at that point. Yeah. He just ended up making. He ended up making stuff. Maybe he ends up making stuff that he feels more. That's more personal, you know, horror stuff than he ends up making. I don't know.
This felt like a really personal movie, though. I mean, yeah. He's really invested in the story. I mean, if you go back to the famed story about, like, the image of Freddy, the visage of Freddy is taken from when he was a kid the burned guy on the street.
You know what I was going to make a reference to earlier was when the whole, like, claw sequence in the tub. It was, I totally blanked that Craven did Deadly Blessing with a snake.
Yeah.
The snake scene where she has the snake come up between her legs. That just... Now it makes complete sense now.
I had forgotten we had done an episode about that.
That leaves us with, you know what, I am just glad that Nightmare hit, because if it didn't, will we ever get My Deadly Friend?
Right.
Because that's a Wes Craven. That's a stinker that you've got to see if you haven't seen it.
I don't think I've ever seen My Deadly Friend.
Oh, you've got to see it.
I'm sorry. I'm thinking of Man's
Best Bebo Friend. With that's what the robot's name is.
Yes.
His name is Debo?
Bebo, I think.
Oh. Christy Swanson.
Christy Swanson, yeah. Throws a basketball at somebody and kills him with a basketball thrown as hard as they can. It's well worth watching.
Will do.
I'm scrolling.
I don't want to spoil any more of it.
I'm scrolling through Wes Craven's filmography. I did, you know, People Under the Stairs. Mm-hmm. Vampire in Brooklyn. Then maybe the scariest one of all, Music of the Heart.
Yeah. I have not seen it.
I've not seen Gloria
Estefan, isn't it?
Yeah, I skipped that one.
Gloria Estefan.
Was she in the movie, or she just do the song for it?
He did The Hills Have Eyes Part 2 and Nightmare on Elm Street the same year.
Oh, well, Hills Have Eyes Part 2 is one of those terrible ones. It's like barely 70 minutes long, and it's composed of... a lot of it's composed of footage from the first one. Like,
oh, right.
You also get a sequence, BB, not Bebo is the robot, BB, but you get a scene from the point of view of the pet dog from the first one. I mean, Hills Have Eyes Part 2 is really bad.
Yeah, I don't know that I've ever seen Part 2. I never really, really liked the first one that much.
I do like the first one. I do, but the second's really bad.
When in high school, when we'd inevitably have the discussion about favorite horror movies, we always had one friend who would go, "Oh, but have you seen The Hills Have Eyes?" We'd be like, well, yeah, we've seen it. It's not that scary.
One of my favorite touches in A Nightmare on Elm Street is the ongoing fight between Sam Raimi and Wes Craven, because the movie that either Johnny Depp or Nancy's watching, it's Nancy at one point, is the movie she's watching is Evil Dead.
That's right.
And in the basement of because in The Hills Have Eyes, don't they? I think they tear up a poster of Jaws. And then in The Evil Dead, in the basement of Evil Dead, in the cabin, there's a poster for The Hills Have Eyes. And so that was sort of a nod to Wes Craven. So in A Nightmare on Elm Street, he returned the favor by putting Evil Dead on the TV. As if to say, that's not real horror. This is real horror.
Oh, so, directors.
I know. Well, there's just such a huge gap between the release, because Evil Dead was filmed in 79 and not released until 82. And so Hills Have Eyes would have been relatively fresh at that point when they filmed it in 79. So,
right.
Anyway. Yeah.
Horrible podcast, guaranteed fresh.
Guaranteed fresh. Yeah, I mean, I don't think we need to do recommendations for these movies because they're classics. But I think this movie still kind of holds up, and in some ways it's very sort of hokey and patchily done. Like the third act still for me doesn't totally work. I love the first two acts. I think they're moody. I think they don't like jump into the horror and like make it so overt. It's all about mood and like the environment being scary and certain things happening that I still find pretty terrifying and good.
I rank it over Friday the 13th.
Yeah.
Oh, definitely.
I think I would rather watch, because Kate was asking me earlier to rank the big four, and obviously Halloween I would put at the top, but I think Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a better movie than A Nightmare on Elm Street, but I would rather watch A Nightmare on Elm Street than Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like just, all the way
it's
through.
It's uncomfortable.
It's just the last act of that movie is so just hard to sit through. Yeah.
Charles Bernstein's score is much more appealing to listen to.
I can't help it.
That's one thing that I hadn't mentioned yet. I mean, that it's Nightmare's score is really, really awesome. Iconic now as well. I mean,
and
people
it sounds
talk about
great.
Friday
like it
all the
up.
Time. They talk about Halloween all the time, but Nightmare's is
those four
the most underrated of all of them. I think
I used five notes shit out of my kid just last night
with the notes.
With the Nightmare on Elm Street, the ding, 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 ding.
Those five notes are amazing.
Yeah, he was thought he was all that, and I went and ran back into the back of the dark bedroom and hid. He started screaming, and then I just played the music.
Oh, to emotionally scar a young person.
And he's like, "Mama," and I was like, "Mama's not here, Jackson."
God,
your mother can't save you now. How close you do have bad dreams?
My recommendation would be to actually watch Never Sleep Again. It's a really, long. It's 4 hours, but it's a really great documentary.
Just watch it in chunks. You can watch it by movie. Watch the segment about it. Watch a movie, watch the segment. Or watch the segment and then watch the movie. It made me want to go back and rewatch Nightmare 2 for the first time in a while. Because the thing is, like I don't really ever have a desire to go watch it. I always kind of want to go watch three. I enjoy 4 and 5 to some extent. They're just fun. I don't really like 6.
I like
Freddy's
4.
Dead.
I think 4's got some really interesting things. I think 5 does too, but it's, man, that movie's in retrospect, that movie's pretty messed up.
Yeah, I don't like Freddy's Dead at all.
No.
I still kind of watching that. Maybe want to go back and watch Freddy versus Jason. Give it another shake. I love the end. I think Freddy's wink, and I think that typifies what Freddy would do. He would let Jason beat him to that point, knowing he's got it in the bag. And when it comes down to it, he's gonna ultimately end up winning this thing.
Whoever wins, we all lose.
Yeah,
that's the tagline
for Aliens versus Predator. But
oh yeah, that's right. I knew it was a tagline to a movie.
A literal tagline. I think I even used that during the last presidential election.
Yeah.
Maybe. Or maybe it was the Ebola outbreak. I don't know. I'm sure I'll put this at some point. Hey, guys. Go see Nightmare on Elm Street if you haven't.
Or see it in a theater near you. There are lines around the block to see this new blockbuster.
Nightmare on Elm Street.
I'm jealous of those days. I would have loved to have done that.
I know.
Well, you know what you can
30
experience?
Years old this year.
Saw Massacre in a theater. Have you ever seen that in a theater?
Uh-uh.
Yeah, I think so.
We also didn't mention that Nightmare on Elm Street is 30 years old this year.
Jesus.
It is. A lot of things about
miles. A lot of miles on that bike.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Thanks for listening. I'm Brian.
I'm Tyler.
And I'm Drew.
We'll talk to you next time.
Sweet dreams.
Matches our song.